If you're looking to level up your night photography, I think this is going to be just the episode for you. Everybody, welcome back to the Learn Landscape Photography Podcast. I'm your host, Austin James Jackson. Super excited to be here today. In this podcast, we are going to be talking about one of the things that challenges so many landscape photographers. Now, if you've downloaded this episode, you already know that in today's episode, we're talking about night photography. So incredibly much to talk about when we are talking about the night sky, and it's something that really challenges a lot of photographers. Now, of course, there's tons of night photography workshops, including ones that I lead, and I've learned in my experience that night photography is just so incredibly challenging, which is kind of already obvious. But the thing that's challenging about it is not only that it's dark out, so you can't see exactly what you're shooting and what you're doing, but you have to kind of put yourself in a different state of mind, because capturing great images at night is totally different than capturing great images during the day. So if you are someone who is either learning night photography, or you're thinking about trying night photography, or even if you're someone that has been shooting night photography for a while, this episode is going to have a ton, and I mean an absolute ton, of helpful tips for you guys in order to improve your night photography, to really level up and take better photos at night. There's so much to learn at night. And in this podcast, we talk about so many different things. I can't even remember all the things we've talked about. I've jotted down a bunch of notes for things that we've talked about, including Astro modified cameras, taking panos, the best star tracker, blending your foreground with your background. There's just so much value in today's episode. We even talk about some night photography gear that's really good. So no matter where you are at your journey in night photography, there's a ton of great stuff for beginners in this episode. There's a ton of great stuff for intermediate, and there's even some really great stuff for advanced photographers. I even learned a few things about Astro modified cameras and things like that that I didn't know before the episode. So I'm really excited to show you guys this episode. I had a conversation with Capture the Atlas, otherwise known as Dan Zafra. He's an amazing photographer, lives in the United States. He's from Spain, and he is just an absolutely phenomenal nighttime photographer. He even does the Milky Way Photographer of the Year that he announces every single, it's like May or June. It just happened recently. And he's just a great person to talk to. He's got some great advice, got so much great stuff on his website. I'm really excited to share with you guys some of the tips that he shared. Of course, links will be down below for anything mentioned in the podcast. I'm really excited, guys. I don't want to wait any longer. Here is my conversation with Dan Zafra. All right, really excited to welcome Dan Zafra to the podcast, otherwise known as Capture the Atlas. I'm really excited to have you here today, Dan, to talk a little bit about astrophotography, which is something that you do incredibly well. I'm a big fan of both your work in photography as well as what you're doing online with your online presence and the blog and the workshops and all that. So much good stuff on your website. Will you first start off by telling us a little about yourself for our viewers that may not know?
Hey, Austin, thank you very much for having me today. Thanks, everybody, for listening. My name is Dan Zafra. I'm a professional landscape and astrophotographer. I'm original from Spain. That's what you can see here, just accent. But I've been based in the U.S. over the last years and currently traveling a lot, doing a lot of astrophotography all around the world, teaching people, sharing, and doing the things I love. So very happy to be here today.
Nice. So I know I just saw, like in the last few days, you recently announced the Milky Way Photographer of the Year. Will you talk about that for a second?
Sure. Yeah. That's something we started doing a few years ago. This year we had the sixth edition. And initially, the goal was to create a Milky Way collection with what we consider the 25 best Milky Way images of the year. And just sharing with the community so we could inspire people to go out, shoot the Milky Way, find new locations. And the timing for that is usually now, end of April, May, which is the beginning of the Milky Way season in the Northern Hemisphere. So we started that as an initiative a few years ago. It's been growing and getting more and more popular. So now the media is giving a lot of coverage to that. But yeah, we're really happy that we're getting the goal. Right now, it's all over the world in all the media, and we're getting to the goal to inspire many people to go out, do more night photography, enjoy nights under the stars. And yeah, it's a really nice and beautiful project.
Yeah, that's awesome. Is there, how can someone get involved? Do you pay to submit images, or do you just, do you personally find the images, or how do you get involved next year?
Yeah, so it's not, some people think it's like a standard contest where you pay money and submit images, but it doesn't work like that. We're usually scrolling images everywhere throughout the year. So it can be either social media, websites, magazines, media, and online websites. It's basically everywhere. Some people submit their images. They send us an email and then send us the images. Some people tag in social media. That really helps because that way we can easily scroll through the images. So people on Instagram and Facebook, they use the hashtag Capture the Atlas, or they use the tag for Capture the Atlas, and we can quickly see the images. And what we do is creating basically a folder with all those candidate images, and then we just do a curation process. This year, for example, we had over 3,000 images, so it was very hard to select only 25 because there are so many great shots. But that's basically the way we do it. So if anybody wants to get involved, the best way is to either email us or send a tag in social media. That's the best way so we can see the images.
Nice. So hashtag capture the Atlas. So if you're a Milky Way photographer out there, make sure you tag that for next year, which will the announcement be around the same time, the beginning of June for next year?
Yeah, we are already collecting images for next year. Usually the period goes from May through April the following year. So until April 2024, we'll be adding images to this new collection. And then we'll close, do the creation. And around mid to late May next year, it'll be announced.
Nice. Well, that's great. Make sure you guys get on that if you're a listener that shoots night photos. I want to talk a little bit, Dan, about your personal process for capturing Milky Way images. Are you doing blur blends, stacked, tracked? How do you usually capture Milky Way images?
Well, I do a little bit of everything. Yeah, it's true that until maybe 2 or 3 years ago, most of my images were either single images or stacking. That was maybe a few blendings every, you know, once in a while, but I'm not very fond of blue hour blends. I prefer to shoot the foregrounds at night, even if it takes longer. But I don't know, it feels more natural to me. But yeah, right now, since the last 2 years, I'm more into tracking. So I started using stat trackers around 3 years ago. And it completely changed my Milky Way photography. I became hooked on using trackers. You know, using like lower ISO, different settings, you can capture longer exposures and get all those beautiful colors, all those nice textures in the night sky in the Milky Way. And right now my process is, I would say, 90% tracking. 10% can be singles stacking depending on the situation. Sometimes it's very windy or it's cloudy and there's like a small window to shoot, or there's like a very complex panorama, it's impossible to track. And in those situations, I still use stacking or single imaging. But 90%, I would say right now, is basically tracking.
Perfect. Do you, I was looking through your blog and you've reviewed so many star trackers. So I figured you'd be a great person to ask about what you think the best star tracker is. And I know you probably get that question a lot. And the answer is probably it depends on what you're trying to do. But just general star tracker for someone that's just starting out star tracking, what tracker are you recommending?
Yeah, that's a very tough question because, as you said, depending on your skills, your background, your goals, your budget, there are at least 3-4 good options. So for beginners, everyone who wants to start tracking, taking their first images, couple of recommendations. One is the MSM, also known as Move Shoot Move. That tracker is a very light, portable tracker. You can carry in your pocket. Lightweight, the payload capacity is not very high, but if you're shooting mirrorless with a prime lens, it's perfectly fine. For doing track panoramas or very complex things, it's not the best option. But for your first track images, it's a very cheap, very affordable tracker, and it can work. Also, if you're starting the Ioptron Sky Tracker, that's also a very good light, portable tracker for beginners. Now, if you want to get more into advanced tracking with a more reliable, sturdy tracker, I recommend either the Ioptron Skyguider Pro or the Skywatcher Star Adventurer Pro. Those two are probably the most popular options. And now we have a third contender in the tracker list. Since last year, probably some people know about this. There's a new tracker called the Venro Polaris. It was designed for Venro. And it's like an automatic tripod head, like a tracker. It does more functions like time-lapse and more stuff. But basically, it's like an automatic tracker. So you can do automatic pro alignment, automatic track panoramas. The learning curve is steeper. It takes much more practice. There are still a few glitches with that tracker, but I've been using that over the last two to three months more intensely, and it's becoming more my primary option because I can just set it up, put the settings, and then have a nap, enjoy the stars, you know, do all of
this. Yeah, that's perfect. And I was just reading on your blog, it looked like you had like a pretty extensive review of that Benro tracker. So that's great. One thing that I was wondering, so you had, actually the first thing that I did want to mention is talking about the payload. So you had mentioned, there was some trackers that are better for a smaller payload. For our listeners out there that aren't sure what that exactly means, the payload is essentially just how much weight you can put on the tracker and it'll still be able to turn. So if you've got like a mirrorless system with a really lightweight pancake lens that weighs nothing, the payload's not really important because you're not going to exceed it. But if you've got like a big heavy setup and you want to use your 100 to 300 lens that's super heavy, you need to pay attention to the payload because not every camera is going to work on every tracker. So for our listeners that don't know what payload is, there you have it. The next thing I want to talk about, I know you had mentioned for your blending, or not necessarily blending, but for your foregrounds, you had said that you like to take a shot at night. That's still something that you're blending with the night sky. Is that correct?
Yes, of course. As long as you're using a star tracker, all your foreground is going to be blurred. Depending on your exposure, if it's 30 seconds, it's going to be, you know, slightly blurred. But if you are shooting, let's say, 2 or 3 minutes, your foreground is going to be completely blurred. So you always, it's mandatory, you need to do a blending with your night sky and your foreground. Even if you shoot, you know, in the same location, in the same spot, the blending is always mandatory.
Yeah. Do you have any advice for our listeners that might be struggling to blend that foreground in that Milky Way, like any advice to making that look seamless?
Yeah, I can give a couple of tips. The first, and this is obviously something that is up to you, but try to track the sky or get images where there are not many overlapping features in the, you know, in the horizon. Like if you, for example, are shooting the, let's say, a landscape with trees, especially trees, branches, things, you know, getting out of the horizon.
Yeah, good luck.
Those are really difficult to blend. So one option, and that will be considered a composite, but, you know, that's up to you. I'm not going to enter into, you know, what's a composite or not, but you can move a few feet away and track the sky in the same location with no trees. That's something that people do. The other option, if you are in Photoshop and you want to do your blending, one very nice tool that you can use, you can go to your filters, other, liquify. Some people know about liquify, the liquify tool. And there's a couple of tools where you can use to shrink your foreground in your track image. So let's make it easy. You capture your sky, your foreground is going to be blurred, and it's going to be larger than your foreground, than your actual foreground. So with the liquify tool, you can go to this tool, shrink your foreground in your sky, in your tracked sky image, and then blend it with your foreground. If you do that slowly and carefully, you can perfectly match your night sky with your foreground. But yeah, if you have like many trees, many branches, that's going to be very, very difficult. So that's up to you, but just, you know, a couple of tips that you can use for blending track shots with normal foregrounds.
Yeah, absolutely. One thing that I always tell people at my workshops is the more contrast that you can have between the foreground shot and the sky behind it that you're going to cut out, the easier the blend is going to be because it makes it a lot easier. But if you're shooting something where there's no contrast between that sky you need to cut out, it is incredibly difficult. And like you said, if you use trees where there's a lot of fine details, it's a huge pain, as opposed to if you use like a rock hoodoo in Utah, is going to be a lot easier to cut out than a tree in the Pacific Northwest. So something to keep in mind if you are newer to blending is to definitely look for those compositions that are going to be easier to blend. Don't try and shoot those compositions where there's trees in the sky, because it's going to be a huge pain. Is there any gear? Obviously, we talked about the star tracker. Is there any gear specifically that you really love, that you really recommend for night photography? This could be like cameras, lenses, filters, anything that you really recommend that people might not know about.
Well, first, I know it sounds pretty basic, but a sturdy tripod, please. That's the first thing you need.
Because honestly,
you know, having people come in on workshops with a super nice camera, you know, one of the top Nikon, Canon, Sony, whatever, a very nice lens, and then they bring this flimsy tripod, which is very shaky, and it can fall. So yeah, first, you know, and foremost, I'll always get a sturdy tripod.
Absolutely.
Mirrorless cameras. I prefer mirrorless. The low light ISO performance is better than older DSLRs. Prime lenses, something that makes a huge difference when you're shooting with a prime, like a 14 1.8. 20 1.8, 24 1.4, any of those lenses are fine. I usually take all my images with two lenses. It's the 20 1.8 or the 35 1.4. I love those two focal lengths for tracking.
And what brand are you shooting on?
I use Sony. Okay. But there are all these third-party lenses like Sigma, Rokinon that you can use a little bit cheaper. Sigma lenses, the optical quality is amazing, but they're very heavy. And yep, that's one of the problems when you are hiking a lot or traveling. So I shoot Sony, mainly the 20, the 35. I have the 14 1.8. That's mainly for normal lights, other types of shooting. But if I'm in a rush, I need to shoot something fast, I can use the 14 1.8. And then as it goes from ball heads, make sure you get a sturdy ball head. If you're using a tracker, make sure you're using a reliable tracker. Don't get any cheap tracker. And yeah, that's basically almost all the things you can use. One very nice tool for shooting vertical and don't have any problems with the cables and all that is a new tool called ATOL, A-T-O-L-L, ATOL. That's like a ring collar that you can put in your camera, attach to your camera, and it allows you to flip your camera horizontal or vertical without no problem. You don't have to use any L bracket, because sometimes people use L brackets. I love L brackets, but sometimes the cables, when you are shooting vertical with a tracker, can get blocked. So using this tool, the official brand is ATOL, but now there are more brands releasing this camera color, like Sunway Photo. I'm not sure if RRS are releasing a new one, but at least the official brand is called ATOL, and that little tool is really helpful when you are shooting at night.
Yeah, that's great. There's actually Slick also makes a little eye bracket, which sounds like it's the same thing where it allows you to go vertical, but it doesn't block the ports like a traditional L bracket. There's certainly a lot of tools like that out there. And one thing I did want to mention for a lot of you guys out there that may be on a little bit of a budget, but you want a nice astrophotography lens. I also shoot Sony. I know they have this lens for, I believe, Canon and Nikon as well. But one lens that I recently picked up that I love for night photography is the Rokinon 14mm f2.8. Certainly not as good as like the Sigma, I think it is 1.8, or maybe it's a Sony, the 14 1.8, but it's a lot cheaper and it's a lot lighter. And if you buy the autofocus version of the lens, it's only like $350 or $400, which is really reasonable for a lens of that quality. So if you're on a budget, definitely consider looking at that. I want to take a break from today's episode and talk about a really cool opportunity if you are a beginner or intermediate photographer that is really serious about taking better photos and getting better at photography. Now, usually about 4 to 6 times a year, I teach in-person workshops around the Western United States centered around helping you become a better photographer. Now, my workshops are kept to just 5 people, which means that you will get plenty of one-on-one attention. So regardless of your skill level, whether you just picked up your first camera or whether you've been shooting for 15 years, I promise you, you're going to get so much out of it. I'm going to cater the class directly to you. Best of all, after the workshop, I'm going to add you to my alumni group on Facebook, where you can get literally weekly image feedback. We can connect at all times. When the workshop is over, it's not done. I'm still going to be your mentor. I'm going to be there to help you and become better at photography. Now, like I said, if you're serious about becoming better at photography, don't wait any longer. Register for one of my workshops this year. You can visit austinjamesjackson.com/workshops. That link will be down below in the podcast description that you can click on as well. I really can't wait to see you guys out there. I know a lot of photographers like to use a light to bring detail to the foreground at night. This is a technique that I see that you don't use a lot, really, if at all. What's your take on it? You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, sure. I mean, some people love light painting. It's completely fine for me. Sometimes it's very annoying when you're in a location and people are flashing lights.
Yeah.
But yeah. But my take is that I, most times, and I would say like, again, like 90% of the times, I prefer natural lighting, especially when you are shooting. I use also an Astro modified camera. We can talk more about that later. But using an Astro modified camera, which is basically a camera without the low pass filter removed, you can capture more light. And when you capture more light, all the landscape, it can look even like daytime. So it allows you to later edit, darken, and you're capturing more light, more quality. So since I'm using an Astro camera, I'm using very fast lenses, like 1.8, 1.4. I capture a lot of light, and I love those landscapes with natural lighting. So I don't use much light painting. Now, there are a few exceptions. One of them is in some of the natural geological formations, like in Utah, where you have these beautiful arches and formations, where sometimes if you illuminate those formations, or caves, you can have, I don't know, like more depth and a different feeling in the image. So those are like a few exceptions where I've used light painting. I use like a flashlight or a mini mag lead flashlight, very basic gear. Some people get more into loom cubes and more stuff, more gear, but I do pretty basic light painting. And again, like most of my images are just natural lighting because that's the way I love seeing the landscapes at night.
Yeah, that's great. Well, you, I know you talked briefly about the Astro modified camera, but how does someone get one? Who do you have a recommendation of where to send it? And then what are the advantages of doing that?
Yeah, Astro modified cameras is basically a process where you remove the low pass filter in your camera, which is blocking the infrared and the ultraviolet light. And by removing that filter, you can install a new filter, allowing the light transmission and capture more light. I know it can sound very technical and complex, but it's actually pretty easy. The only thing you have to do is to send the camera to a lab. I never recommend doing this at home because technically you can do it yourself, but you can easily break your camera. And I know many people who have broken their camera doing the process themselves. So send it to a lab. There are labs all over the world doing this process. In the US, there are a couple of labs. The main lab, I think, is Spencer's Camera. And the second lab is LightPixel. Those two are the main providers for Astro modifications. I've done all my Astro modifications with a Spencer's Camera. It's based in Northern Utah. And I don't have any complaints. Everything has been working great because when you modify your camera, there are a few things to consider. Like you can lose your automatic white balance. Your focus plane can be changed as well. So that's why it's very important to go to a very professional with a good reputation photography lab so they can do this modification for you. The result is a couple of things. The first thing, you can capture more colors and more light in the hydrogen alpha regions of the night sky. So those pinkish, reddish colors that you see in some images, again, you can capture with a stock camera. With a normal camera, you can get maybe 20-25% of those colors. With an Astro modified camera, you can get up to 90%. So you're capturing those colors that are not visible to the naked eye, only to the camera. Secondly, you're capturing more light. It's about, I would say, like a stop more of light, which is something huge in night photography. So instead of shooting exposure for maybe 2 minutes with a tracker, you can shoot for 1 minute and still capture a lot of light. And same for the foregrounds. I tell this to everybody. When you think about Astro modifications, don't think only about the sky. Think about the foreground. They're capturing much more light, quality, cleaner foregrounds. So that's a turning point also if you are, I would say, like a little bit more advanced. If someone is just starting out, I wouldn't recommend getting an Astro modified camera. But if you are comfortable with the basics, you have a solid foundation in Milky Way, you can send a second body to AstroModify, or you can just buy a brand new AstroModify camera, and that can be a turning point in your night photography.
What are we talking price wise? I you don't have to give me an exact number, but are we talking like a couple $100, $500, $1,000? What are they charging to do that?
Yeah, depending on the lab, the camera, and the process, it can go from $250 up to $450.
Okay, that's not too bad.
Yeah, it's not too bad. It's actually cheaper than a lens, and the change is drastic. Some of the labs offer some optional items, like for example, a cooling system, so you can install like cooling pads in your camera, and that way your camera is going, especially shooting in the summertime, long exposures, you can get this noise from the heat. So you can have like a cooler, you know, it's going to be cooling system in your sensor, and it's going to make everything cleaner with less noise. And that's maybe like $50 extra. But yeah, roughly between $300-$350, most of the modifications, yeah, you can get for that price.
Yeah, that makes sense. And then once you do that, though, like you're not using that camera for landscapes anymore because the colors will be weird. Is that correct?
Yeah, technically, yes. But depending on the modification that you can do, if it's like a normal, it's called hydrogen alpha modification, which is a basic modification, you can set a custom white balance in your camera using a gray card. And with that custom white balance, you can perfectly shoot during the day. All the colors will look completely natural, but there's a couple of exceptions. If you are shooting at a very strong light source, let's say you're doing a sun star, or shooting like a very strong light, you can see some red halos in the image. So there are some limitations. That's why I recommend AstroModifying a second body or buying a specific camera, you know, for night photography. If you only have one camera, I wouldn't do it. That's my personal take.
Yeah, that's great advice. And how, one thing as you were talking that I kind of thought about is how long after sunset are you, or before sunrise, are you shooting your foreground image? Are you actually shooting it when it is completely dark, or are you taking that at a different time of night?
Yeah, it depends on the situation. I try to capture it at night because when you're in the blue hour, of course you can capture more light, more quality, but sometimes it's a little bit evident that it doesn't feel like night. I don't know if I'm explaining myself, but you can sometimes tell the difference. You can tell the difference very quickly when it's a blue hour blend or it's like a night image blend. So I try, if I'm tracking, for example, as either before my tracking or after, depending on the Milky Way. Sometimes, you know, spring is rising later at night, so I can do it before. In the summertime, late summer is rising after sunset, so I can do it after the shoot. And I try to do it at night, so completely dark. I just, you know, set like a longer exposure, maybe 3-4 minutes, and I do my foreground. Sometimes there are no options, and I do a blue hour blend. But in most situations, I'm just capturing my foreground at night.
And what, like, I know it depends on the situation, but like, what are you aiming to get your ISO and your shutter speed at for that foreground shot when it's dark out?
Yeah, the ISO is actually higher. Some people are surprised, like, wow, you're shooting at 6400 ISO or for your foreground. I say, yes, if you're shooting 3-4 minutes at a high ISO, the noise is not going to be very noticeable. Because most people think that high ISO means high noise, but that's not always the case. High ISO, short exposure, yes, it's going to be very noisy because you're losing all the dynamic range in a very short exposure. But in some cameras, actually shooting a higher ISO is going to be a cleaner image. It all depends on the shutter speed. So if I'm shooting my foreground, let's say in a very dark location, I'm here now in Southern Utah, and it's really dark at night. If I'm shooting, let's say 3-4 minutes, and I shoot with ISO 5000 or 6400, the noise is minimal. And then I can use, I know that you also use this software, Topaz, the noise AI, or Topaz Photo AI. So you can, you know, if it's like a little bit of noise, you can clean it up very fast in one click with this software. I've been using Topaz for many years, and I love it. And the image is going to be 100% clean. There's no difference. So that's usually my go-to settings for foreground.
Yeah, perfect. Great information there for someone if you're going out there to shoot your foreground. Is there any special considerations that need to be made for Milky Way panos? I see you shoot quite a few panos.
Yeah, for panoramas, well, that would take like another podcast just for panoramas. But just some basic things. It depends if you are tracking or not tracking. If for general panoramas, regardless of tracking or not, make sure, and I'm talking about the main mistakes I've seen people in workshops, make sure you capture enough room on the edges. Because some people like shooting, okay, here's my Milky Way core, I'm going to the tail of the Milky Way, capturing the full arch, and then start shooting my first image from the Milky Way core.
Not
then
enough.
Then sometimes when you are stitching, you are running into issues, like you don't have enough space, you're missing information. That's why when you're capturing an arch, let's say in the Northern Hemisphere, go to, I would say, 180 degrees. So if you open your arms and it's like 180, that's what you need to capture. It doesn't matter if you are cropping later, but it's better to have more information and crop than running out of space and say, okay, now I'm missing this piece here and I need to clone and I need to do more, you know, more things. Also on the top, some people don't capture enough room on top of the Milky Way. So if you are, again, Northern Hemisphere, my reference, go to the center of the arch, get a Vega, the star Vega. It's a very bright star, which is in the middle of the arch. And that will be in your frame always. That means that you're capturing enough room for your Milky Way arch. And that way it's not very close to the border to the frame of the image. That's my first tip. Second tip, check all your images. Because some people are shooting at night, they get excited. They check their first image in the panorama. Everything is looking fine. And then when they get back home, they notice that maybe one or two shots were blurry or shaky. So that's why in a panorama, always check all your images. That's something that is very basic, but it's going to save you a lot of headaches
when you're at home. Of course.
Yeah. And if you're tracking, I think it's much more complex. You need to know where you need to start shooting. You need to make calculations for the timing. And again, that will be for another podcast, but yeah, for tracking, you need to be much more careful with the timing, with the calculations, and with more things.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you have any advice for people out there trying to focus at night? I know there's a few different techniques that you can use, but one thing that I find is a lot of people are struggling to get their camera and their focus tack sharp at night.
Yeah, some people like doing the basic process of, I don't know, let's say you're doing the daytime sunset, you focus on infinity and then you tape the lens. I don't teach that way because sometimes there's no other option. In some occasions you have to focus at night. And for me, my goal for me and my students is always to focus your lens completely at night. And if possible, with no other help. So without using flashlights, without using any external lights, just the stars. I believe that any astrophotographer should lend, you know, that way for focusing, because it's there are some situations where it will be you yourself and the stars, and you really need to know how to focus on the stars, you know, when you're alone. That said, to me, the easiest way, if you're using mirrorless cameras or some older advanced DSLRs, use focus peaking. That really helps. You can say the focus peaking is basically like a focus and manually aid. It's like a visual reference. So everything in focus is going to be turning in a color.
Usually red by default.
Yeah. Some cameras, I don't know if it was Nikon or Canon, they said the white by default or the blue. And that's really difficult to see. So always set the red color in your peaking. And medium level is fine. Yeah, if you set like a high peaking level, sometimes it's difficult to tell when it's in focus. If it's really low, happens the same thing. So medium reference is fine. I mean, medium reference in your peaking. And then it's basically using always focus in your center of your lens. So when you're pointing your camera at the sky and your lens, always make sure the stars that you're using as a reference is in the center of your lens. Because if there's some coma in your lens in the corners, you're going to be using a wrong star, you know, with a lot of coma for your focus. So always use the center of your lens as a reference. Then you magnify. So use a camera focus magnifier. Canon and Nikon, there's like this magnifying glass that you can press a couple of times. Sony, you can find it in the menu. I recommend for Sony shooters using a custom button for your focus magnifier. So magnify, make sure you see the stars very big. And then just turn your focus lens slowly until you get a sharp stars. Always, you know, double check your images and repeat, you know, as many times as you need. for people who are struggling to focus still with this process, some of them have bad eyesight, they don't see very well, there's a couple of tools that you can use. The first, you can use a loop. Some people, you can get a loop on Amazon, it's like 10, 15 bucks, and you can put this loop in your live view. I didn't mention this, but always use your live view because sometimes I see people, you know, trying to use the viewfinder.
Yeah.
Use the live view, and if you have very bad eyesight, this loop can help you magnify the stars. Second, there is another tool, it's a filter. It's called Focus on Stars filter. It was designed by a Hungarian astrophotographer. Some people I've seen using these filters, I've tried it myself. Honestly, I don't need it, but for some people in our workshops, it's really helpful because they use this filter. You see like a pattern in the stars, it's like a spikes. And when all the spikes are aligned, it means that the stars are in focus. So if you struggle with focusing, those couple of tools can be very helpful. That's the basic process. It's just a lot of practice. So practice as much as you can with your focus.
Yeah, just a couple notes on a few things that you said that I wrote down here. First thing, for our listeners that don't know, you had mentioned coma, which for our listeners that don't know, that essentially is just on lenses that might not be as great for astrophotography, might have what's called coma on the edges, which is where in the center, your stars are going to be perfectly sharp, perfectly round. On the edges, your stars are going to almost look like they're trailing, like they might just be abnormal shapes. That's essentially coma. So you need to make sure that you focus on a star in the center, not on the edge. From my personal experience, I also know it's really helpful to find a bright star in the sky because not all stars are made equal for focusing purpose. So do find one that's really bright, aim your camera right at it. That's going to be a great way to focus. And then the other thing that I wanted to note, I talked to a lot of people that think that just that the infinity focus on their lens is truly infinity. I cannot tell you how wrong this is. I have worked with so many clients And I've owned so many lenses myself, and I've never seen a single lens where infinity is truly the infinity focus for stars. You always have to dial it back. So don't think that you can just dial your focus all the way to infinity because you usually will have to dial it back. Do you have pretty similar experience as well?
Yeah. I don't know. For some reason, it must be some manufacturers, you know, protocol. They need to set this infinity sign there, but it never works. It's always a little bit further back, and yeah, it requires some fine-tuning your lens. And the best way is to, whenever you get a new lens, practice as much as you can with that new lens, because every lens is different focusing, and every camera as well. But lenses is very critical. Some lenses are easier to focus, some are more difficult. So yeah, don't trust your infinity sign in your lens. Always, you know, run your test and always make sure that your stars are perfectly sharp.
Yeah, and even if you're shooting the same lens as, like, say, somebody else, your friend, you've got the exact same lens, where their focus on the stars is on their manual focus ring is not necessarily going to be the same for you because each lens is unique. So you can't just look online or something like that. You actually have to figure it out for your lens. And what I always tell people is that worst case scenario, if you're in the field by yourself and you can't figure it out, simply just guess and check. Take a photo, see if it's sharp. If it's not sharp, do it again. Obviously, this is not the best way to do it, but if all else fails, the guess and check method is definitely better than coming home with some blurry images.
Yeah, and another tip, Austin, if I can add to that, is some manufacturers have, I don't know if it's their quality, I don't know, the quality standards are different. So from Sony to Canon to Nikon, going to third-party lenses, they change a lot. And sometimes, you know, there are bad copies. So people say, okay, I have a bad copy of this lens. That means that when you are focusing at night, the focus is slightly off or you have a lot of coma. And that means that you're having a bad copy in your lens. Usually it's very rare to see in primary lenses like Sony, Nikon, Canon, Fuji. It's very rare. I've seen cases in some Sony lenses, for example, but in some third-party lenses, Rokinon especially, for some reason, Rokinon have a lot of bad copies. It's very affordable lenses. They are very, you know, high-quality lenses, but still, if anybody's buying any, not only Rokinon, any lens, make sure you are running tests when you buy it. Just go, you don't need a Milky Way, just go outside and make sure your stars are fine. Of course, some lenses have some coma. That's inevitable, especially wide angles. But if you see like more coma than you should have, you can check reference images online. You probably have to send the lens back to the manufacturer or to the store and get a new copy. because I've seen that happen in a few cases.
Yeah, that's good thing to note there for people. Just a couple more questions here. I don't want to take too much of your time. Is there any common mistake that you see a lot of beginners making out there when they're shooting the night sky?
Well, the main common mistake I think I already mentioned, it's getting too excited and don't check in your images.
So, yeah.
That's why I tell always people, like, there are a couple of things you should always do. Like, first of all, lower your camera brightness, because that can trick your eye when you are shooting at night. So lower your camera brightness. And apart from, you know, checking your focus, we already mentioned that, check your focus. And lastly, always check your histogram, because people don't usually check their histograms at night for some reason. And that's the best way to know how's your exposure and how's the image you're capturing. So those three things, always make sure you're doing them at night, and especially the histogram, because you might forget to turn down the camera brightness. Maybe you're in a spot with some external lights. So check your images. And also when you're doing panoramas, make sure you're leaving an enough room and you're checking every single image to make sure that everything is looking fine.
Great advice. Last question that I always ask here on the Learn Landscape Photography podcast is, there's a lot of listeners that we have on this podcast that are trying to become better photographers. Do you have any one single piece of advice for someone that's a landscape photographer and they want to take better photos? It doesn't have to do with today's episode or night photography or anything. Just one piece of advice for someone that wants to get better at photography.
Yeah, I think the key for all this, it doesn't matter if you're doing astro, landscape, wildlife, whatever you're doing. It's up, at the end of the day, is to be passionate about it and just, you know, shoot as much as you can. Practice a lot. Don't be afraid of going out. Don't be afraid of going out at night. Don't be afraid of Photoshop or the editing techniques. Sometimes we feel overwhelmed, especially when they are trying new camera gear, new techniques, new editing techniques, new software. We find them very daunting and we don't even try. So my advice to everybody is to just, you know, go out, shoot as much as you can, practice. There's a lot of trial and error. So it's, you know, everybody goes through the same process. We all get crappy images when we're starting, and then we get better. Just, you know, do it with passion, do it every day as much as you can. And with the time, you will see the results. It's a matter of putting the time, putting the love for this craft.
That's great. Well, thank you so much for being here. Will you just tell us to kind of end off the podcast here? I know you've got so much great stuff online. Give us the rundown of what you've got that's online that we can buy, that we can read, that we can learn from your workshops. Give us the whole rundown. What do you got for us?
Yep. So all my stuff is in CaptureTheAtlas.com, and you can find free photography articles, guides, tutorials, inspirational articles. All that is for free on the website, and you can learn a lot of stuff there. Then we have like a freemium access, like my Milky Way course. I have a full Milky Way course with more than 24 hours covering everything from the basics, all the things we were discussing, like focusing, basic panoramas, stacking, all the way to very high complex technical trap panoramas, editing of picture with astro modified cameras. So it can get very technical, and everything in between. So there are like three courses. You can check it out online. And if anybody wants to get a discount, they can send me an email to info@CaptureTheAtlas.com, and I'll be happy to provide a discount for all the listeners to your podcast. And then for the workshops and tours, everything is on the website. We are currently launching all the tours for next year. A lot of international trips, like in Atacama, Bolivia for Milky Way, Patagonia, some workshops in the US as well, in Utah, Death Valley. So everything is on CaptureTheAtlas.com. They can subscribe to our newsletter and get notified when there's a new workshop. And yeah, I'll be always more than happy to help. So if anybody has any questions, I'm always, you know, you can reach out to me, email, social media. I'll be happy to help.
Nice. Well, if you guys are trying to learn and become better astrophotographers, I think there is few people that are better to learn from than Dan, otherwise known as Capture the Atlas. Again, Dan, I want to thank you so much for being here today. Such a great episode, and I think there's so much value here. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast today.
Yeah, thank you, Austin, for having me. It's been a pleasure to be here today, and I'll be happy to talk again whenever you like.
Well, so incredibly much to love about today's podcast. I mean, I don't even know where to start. If you guys listen to this the first time and you were driving or running or whatever you do when you listen to podcasts and you weren't able to jot down any notes, I would highly recommend watching this again. Get a notepad out, jot some notes down, and bring it with you the next time you go into the field, because there is just so much great stuff in this podcast. So many great tips that you would otherwise have to scour YouTube for hours for or come out on a workshop for. You just got them all in this podcast. Short, sweet, straightforward, to the point. Exactly what I like, and I really hope it was helpful for you guys. If you guys have any questions following today's episode, please feel free to let me know. As always, really, really would appreciate if you guys leave a review wherever you listen to podcasts. It really helps me to continue to make these free podcasts, and as you know, my free YouTube as well. I want to thank you guys so much for checking this week's podcast out. We will see you guys next time. This is Austin James Jackson signing out.